I'm Shiv Gulani, welcoming you to Raise the Line with Osmosis from Elsevier, an ongoing exploration about how to improve health and healthcare. The healing power of music is not just a matter of conventional wisdom. Multiple studies have validated its effectiveness for a wide range of issues, from asthma to depression to brain disorders such as Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, and epilepsy. This might explain why both public and private sector sources are predicting a positive outlook for the profession in job openings in the coming years. Today on the podcast, we're going to learn all about this fascinating field and its role in healthcare from Carrie Devlin, a senior music therapist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Music and Medicine. Carrie has worked as a music therapist for a decade and is currently a PhD researcher in the doctoral program in music therapy at Aalborg University. As a disabled clinician, she is passionate about disability justice and affirming the lived experiences of patients through co-constructed music experiences and research endeavors. I'm looking forward to talking about those aspects of her work, as well as gaining a better understanding of the clinical applications of music therapy. And on a personal note, I met Carrie when I was on my neurology clerkship, and we went down to the neurocritical care unit and actually were able to record heartbeat and breath sounds of one of the patients who was undergoing palliative care, and it was one of the most meaningful experiences I've had in med school to date. So, Carrie, thanks for not only that experience, but for taking the time to be with us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So we always ask our guests to, in their own words, kind of tell us how they got to where they are. So what got you interested in music and then ultimately music therapy?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm a musician at heart. I've always been a musician. I'm a singer, kind of first and foremost. And I actually have a bachelor's degree in classical singing, but I found myself kind of losing a little bit of joy for the art, you know, going through the audition circuit. And it's a real grind and it's really competitive and it's a lot of practicing and dedication and commitment. And I wanted to find ways to kind of recultivate my joy for making music and found a lot of joy in making music with other people. So I had a job as an early childhood music educator at an inclusive preschool, and I just loved it. I loved making music with families and with kids and finding ways to meet kids' access needs in different ways through music. And I just kind of slowly found my way to music therapy. I went back to school and did a graduate program and then found myself working as a clinician, which was not something I thought I would be doing, but ended up being a really good fit for me, you know, a way to kind of meld my love for musicking with other people and also being with people on whatever journey they're experiencing.
Yeah. And I mean, it was, again, incredible to witness just a part of like an hour in the life together. One thing we've really been promoting a lot of Osmosis has been kind of the holistic aspects of people's lives beyond just giving them, you know, drugs or surgeries to cure them. There's a lot more, you know, lifestyle behavior modifications, getting them appropriate sleep, diet, et cetera. And music is definitely a part of someone's experience. I mean, very rarely do you meet someone who doesn't enjoy music of some sort. So I'm curious, you know, how would you define like music therapy? Because I'm sure a lot of our audience, they probably have Spotify playlists galore. What is the difference between like just listening to music and what you do as music therapy?
Yeah. So one important differentiator is, you know, we can all use music therapeutically in our own lives. I think to your point, most people engage in that practice really intuitively, but music therapy is an allied health profession wherein there is a therapeutic relationship between a certified and in some states licensed music therapist and a patient or a client or a therapy participant, you know, in many different clinical settings. And so I like to kind of describe it as a relational therapeutic encounter. So music is both the tool that I'm using as a music therapist, but it's also the medium that we're working in. And we're using that tool and that therapeutic medium to travel together to work towards someone's individualized healthcare goals. And so music therapy sessions, kind of like many folks have experienced a talk therapy session, and I would kind of liken it to that. There is a lot of talking. You can't just jump right into making music with someone. We have to get a sense of who they are and how they engage in music and what's going on in their lives and what's meaningful to them. And so music therapy is very process oriented and is really, for me, working in a medical setting, about holding space for someone, for their life circumstances, their needs, their desires for themselves, giving an opportunity to even just make a choice. To choose a song seems like a really small thing, but it's a really empowering thing when you don't have a lot of choices available to you. It's a way to have a little bit of control over your environment. And it's a way to also change the aesthetic of the environment. You know, hospitals have a very specific aesthetic. There's a lot of beeps, a lot of background noise, and a lot of distressing sounds, you know, especially for folks, you know, for patients' families or for patients themselves who are in and out of consciousness, and it's a very disorienting environment. And so music can be a very grounding and regulating experience. So every music therapy session looks different. The session you saw is what it was, and maybe an end-of-life encounter with another patient would be quite different depending on who they are and what they need in the moment, because it's really all about kind of honoring what that person needs and using music reflexively to respond to those needs in the moment.
Absolutely. And I'm gonna jump around because you mentioned the clinical encounter we had together, which again, I can put myself in the room just to paint the picture for our audience. You know, I asked Carrie to shadow her for a couple hours on my neurology clerkship. And we went down to Hopkins third floor, the neurocritical care unit. And there was a patient, an elderly woman who was unfortunately going to pass away. And we were with her and her family. And Carrie introduced me to something amazing called a heartbeat song, which I'd never heard of, but a few popular artists have done it. And I'll let Carrie describe exactly how she does it and whatnot. And basically use the stethoscope to get as much of the heartbeat as we could. And this particular patient was very hard to hear her heartbeat, but we got breath sounds just because of her pathophysiology, what was going on, and played her favorite song, which was a Harry Belafonte song, Jamaica Farewell. Everyone was crying, including me. I just met the patient's family. And then Carrie went about and juxtaposed that song, sang the song, and juxtaposed it to the heartbeat and the breath sounds in a way that was very authentic and meaningful, and gave that to the family. I don't actually know how they received it, but maybe you can add to this, Carrie, and also share some of the memorable experiences you've had doing these heartbeat songs.
Yeah, gosh, doing this work is such a gift. If you had asked me, I don't know, 10 years ago when I was first starting as a clinician, would you ever work in an end-of-life context? I would have said, heck no. No way am I equipped to do that. That is way too big. I'm not ready. But I've really found myself over the years, the more that I sit with people and hear their stories and have the absolute joy of being a small piece of someone's journey, you know, in the worst moment of their lives, to be able to bring a little bit of joy or a little bit of playfulness or a little comfort is such a gift that honestly kind of blows me away every time. Like the only way I can describe it is like a sacred space. And even though I offer this project to patients across the hospital, it's something that I do pretty regularly, one or two, or sometimes even three a week, I find like the experience to really just sit with someone, to ask them about their loved one, to hear their stories, to watch videos and look at photos of them, and to get a sense of who they are, and then to get to craft that heartbeat song recording in a way that reflects something about what I've learned about that person. It's a way for me to process my grief, especially if it's someone I've worked with multiple times, or it's a, you know, a longer term patient and relationship. You know, I feel that loss deeply. And even if it's just one time, you can feel the weight of what that means for the people in that patient's life. And it's like, you know, getting to know them a little bit through their eyes. And so for me, it's such a special thing. It's sometimes a musical challenge, you know, because our heartbeats and our breath are rhythmic, but not always. You know, sometimes there's syncopation, or if someone is actively dying, their heartbeat might have a really flexible rhythm where there's a lot of space. And we try, when I make these recordings, I try really hard to use that person's authentic rhythm. Like that is a little bit of who they are. I like to leave breath sounds. And I explain to family, that's what you're hearing is somebody's breath, like their life is in this. And so I try to structure the music around that. And it's really different for every person. You know, I've done heartbeat songs quite literally to happy birthday, or to lullabies for young children, to songs I've never heard of that I get to sit down and really learn and aesthetically change it to just kind of reflect the encounter that I had with their family. And so for me, it's I think really a gift to get to offer that to people and to receive their response when they're ready. Sometimes it's not right away. Sometimes it's months and months later when they're finally able to open the song and listen to it and process it. And it's just, it feels special every time. And for me, I'm grateful for the opportunity because, you know, you witness a lot of things when you work in a critical care context. And I think it's important to have an outlet and a ritual to process your grief and the weight of what you're experiencing. And for me, those heartbeat songs are part of my grief processing ritual, where I really sit down intentionally and use that time to, you know, I cry a lot when I make them. I have to, especially when I'm doing the vocals, I often have to pause. Sometimes I leave in if I have an inauthentic break or I've become emotional. Sometimes I leave it in and I tell the family, you know, I quite literally couldn't sing this without becoming tearful. But I find that's just deepened the relationships that I have with folks, because I think it's an authentic reflection of the impact their loved one had on somebody else who didn't even get to meet them in many cases. And so it's just a really special, sacred thing to get to do. It's one of the most important things I feel like I get to do in my job.
Yeah, it's, again, very profound. And I hope that the audience listening has the ability to shadow a music therapist as I did, maybe pursue it as an adjunctive field, or, you know, it's obviously a high growth field. So we know a lot of clinicians with great music talent who could bring that in and learn from people like you, Carrie. What do you mind sharing one or two examples that really stick with you? And then also beyond heartbeat songs, what does a day in the life look like for you? Because one time I saw you were working with somebody in a coma, and we all know the Glasgow Coma Score, the GCS, you know, and I think you apply a musical lens to their neurological function. So first, memorable experiences, and second, what does a day in the life look like for you?
Oh, so many memorable experiences. I mean, I think thinking about like coma stim, that's kind of a unique thing about working in a neurology context, you know, and to get to use music in a way that is both supporting someone's physiologic stability. You know, there's a good body of evidence that shows us, you know, our bodies automatically respond to music that's in the environment. And that can be both in a helpful way and in a harmful way. You know, if we are having a very high respiration rate and I come in and start, I don't know, playing some really, really fast like rock song, you might start breathing faster. And that's something that is maybe beyond your ability to control. And so when I'm making music with someone, especially somebody who's not totally conscious, my role is really to shape the music very strategically and intentionally around their neurologic and their sensory needs. And so I'm working with the monitor. Often I'm consulting with physicians on the team, with nursing and with the OTs and PTs and speech therapists, all the folks who are providing coma stim. And I'm, you know, asking questions. Like, you know, what are our target vital ranges, or, you know, where do we want, you know, when do I need to pull back the stimulation? If we, you know, when a patient becomes, when they're like, we're getting a little tacky, I know I need to pull back the stimulation, or I need to slow down the tempo of the music that I'm playing. So I'm often improvising, you know, I might be playing structured songs, things that I know the patient likes, but I might also just be playing very fluidly and flexibly because I'm trying to give a really intentional stimulus to see how does this person physiologically respond to music? Are they alerting? Are they localizing to the sound? If I move to the other side of the bed, are they turning? You know, if they have some consciousness, are they fixing their gaze on me, or are they not able to do that? And so I'm able to kind of provide, you know, the same kinds of really important sensory stimulation, but in a very controlled way where I'm also working with that person's vitals, making sure I'm not overstimulating someone or putting them over the threshold of what their brain and body can handle at the point, you know, given where they are in their medical journey. And so that's like one thing I get to do. I also work with people who are conscious. I feel like all the examples I've given you are, you know, me mostly working with families and with folks, you know, who are maybe not able to actively engage in their care. But I also really get to work with patients. I've gotten to encounter sometimes musicians. That's some of the most fun for me, is when I encounter another patient, a patient who is a musician themselves. But perhaps, you know, I work in neurology and I've worked with a musician who had a really serious neurologic event and lost their ability to play in the same way. And this was someone who was a professional musician, and that was really intrinsic to their identity. And I met them really early on in their ICU stay. And the first thing that they really were able to do was I slid a keyboard, you know, working with PT and OT, there were like four people in the room, and their fingers made their way to the keyboard and played a little bit. And it was a really big deal. And all the way I got to follow this patient through their stay of over many weeks, it was months, honestly. And by the end, we were singing and playing songs together and writing music together. And they were able to not play in the same way they could before, but we were able to process the loss of those skills to troubleshoot how can we, you know, okay, if we have less use of our left hand, like how can we maximize our right hand action? We need looping pedals. We need, you know, things that are going to enable you to layer sounds in the same way that you could. So like getting to work really collaboratively with folks to meet their access needs and to also process, you know, for somebody like a musician who can't play in the same way aesthetically, that is a massive loss. Anybody who's a musician will understand that. And it's like a gut punch, you know, to not be able to play the way that you want to. And so I think it's a really special thing to also get to support someone as they're moving through that process of like identity reformation, and then also the playfulness of rediscovering new ways of playing. So those are definitely some really special things that I get to do. And I get to play a lot of different songs, like really all over the place music all day long. And it's really kind of fun, but it does skew my Spotify account.
I bet.
In a good way.
I'm sure there's some songs you've discovered from your patients that now are probably things you listen to regularly.
Yeah, I have a ritual that I do for myself as part of my grief processing. I have a playlist where I add like one song for a patient who I've worked with who has passed. And so typically that's the song that is, you know, used in their heartbeat song recording, but sometimes it's something different. If it was a longer term relationship and there was something we played together often. And so for me, when someone passes, I add a song to that playlist. And for me, it's like a visual thing for me. I can sit down and look at, wow, that's a long playlist. That's a lot of people who I've encountered who've, you know, transitioned, but also that's a lot of people who I got to share space with and I got to be a little part of their story. And so for me, sometimes when I'm processing the loss of a patient, I listen to my sad playlist, which is a real hot tip for anybody who's looking to use music to regulate, you know, in medical school or nursing school or whatever you're moving through. Make like, we need a feel all our feelings playlist. And sometimes you need to just put it on and cry it out and have a little catharsis, just like we listen to different music when we're exercising and different music when we want to focus. Like our bodies are so responsive to music, and we can use that to our advantage and to also intentionally make space to work through things that we're feeling and experiencing.
100%. I love all that. And it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from Maya Angelou, which was, I'm sure you've heard this, people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And that's one reason I wanted to have you on the podcast, because I think, you know, obviously everyone in the healthcare system is doing the best work they can, whether it's the person billing to make sure the hospital is self-sustaining, or it's obviously I just did a shout out to scrub techs. It's a career people don't really think about that much, but like, clearly, it isn't just a surgeon in the room. It's all the circulating nurse, the scrub tech, even the person just wheeling the patient in, some med student placing the Foley. Who knows? It's a whole bunch of different people who come together. And one reason I'm so glad Hopkins has the music therapy program, and we're going to transition to asking you more about that, is because I think hospitals, as you said, can be so barren, so stark. And one of the things I hate, we have to do it, but is the rounding in the morning. With neurosurgeons right now, I'm rounding. I hate it for the patients because oftentimes we're waking them up at like 5:30 a.m. I'm like, man, like, I know we have to do this because you're starting surgery rotations at 7:30. I don't know if you have to do it. I think there's ways to do it better, but I'll correct myself on that. I don't think we have to do it. But someone who like sleep is restorative for them, we're waking them up after maybe they had so much pain, they only got to bed at 2 a.m. and now we're waking them at 5:30, like do a couple exams on them. Why can't we let them sleep a couple more hours? So they'll remember that negatively, right? The hospital had bad food and didn't sleep that well. They didn't even introduce themselves in some cases. But then you come along and, you know, give them a super meaningful experience that I'm sure is a highlight of their otherwise very negative experience being in a hospital, because nobody really wants to be there unless they're maybe having a child. So can you tell us a bit about Hopkins music therapy program? How widely, like, when do you think all hospitals will have this? Should all hospitals have it, et cetera? I'd love to get more of your take on that.
Yes, I would love for all hospitals to have one or a team of music therapists, because I you know, I'm the first at Hopkins. So when I was hired, there were no other music therapists on staff. So my job has really been to start building a program. And I'm able to do that with this amazing lab that I work with, the Johns Hopkins Center for Music and Medicine, that is led by neurologist Dr. Alex Pantoliat, who is a musician and such a fierce advocate for music and music therapy and being integrated into healthcare. And so it's wonderful to work with a team of physicians. We have a wonderful postdoc fellow who's also a music therapist. We have researchers and speech language pathologists and OTs and PTs and nurses and people who we're essentially, we don't have a brick and mortar location, but we're like a collective of people who all really believe strongly in integrating music into healthcare. And so I, as part of my job as the first on-staff clinician, you know, I've started a lot of community-facing programs like support groups for people who have movement disorders and neurologic diagnoses. We have some long-running programs that are led by music therapists and choral conductors and folks in the community, like a choir, for folks who have Parkinsonian disorders, because singing is really, really great for maintaining your vocal loudness and your articulation and your pacing and all of those things. We have drumming groups for folks who have movement disorders, because rhythm is such a regulating thing, and our brains and our bodies entrain, they synchronize with rhythm in the environment. So even if somebody has, you know, festination of gait, you know, that shuffling gait you get in Parkinson's disease, if you introduce a steady pulse into the environment, and there's a whole formula for doing that music therapists do. But when you introduce a steady beat, that person will eventually begin to synchronize their gait with that beat, and they will have longer stride length and better arm swing, and it will ultimately be safer and less likelihood of falls. And that's like just with rhythm, like a metronome. Add music over it, sometimes it can be even more engaging. And so we have kind of all of these community facing programs. And now that those have been up and running, now my job was, okay, I want to start programs at bedside, because I know we have a lot of need. And so I worked on the pediatric side for about a year in critical care there, and they've just hired their first music therapist, who's been here about 2 months working in the pediatric ICUs. And so now I'm totally embedded on the adult side and hoping to do the same thing, because I really do believe, you know, I get so many referrals, and it's so challenging to prioritize. And to know that, you know, I might get 15 or 20 referrals in a day on the units that I serve, then only be able to see 4 or 5 patients. And so I have to make really tough decisions in collaboration with the healthcare team to assess, you know, for whom is this a necessity? And I think there are many patients on my list for whom this kind of encounter would be a necessity, but we have to prioritize, you know, folks who are in respiratory distress or are having high pain or who are actively dying and need, their family needs a lot of support. And so I wish there were many more of me, because there are no limits to what we could achieve if there were more music therapists. You know, ideally, we'd want music therapists embedded in different units so that they get to know the culture of the unit. They get to really know the patients and the providers and are really fully integrated into the team. That's like a best case scenario.
Wow, that's awesome. And congrats on growing the programs here at Hopkins. And one other name I'll mention that you and I spoke about 2 months ago when we met is Fred Barrett, who we had in the podcast, the head of the Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. And talking to him and Rick Doblin and Manish Agarwal, some other pioneers in psychedelic therapy, obviously the role of music is extremely important there when people are even more, you know, permeable, I think, to the set and setting, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's super cool to see how that'll come into play. I did want to, I mean, again, one of the reasons I love this is, you know, something you said, I have a follow-up question on, which is, have you noticed either anecdotally or are there studies about whether music at certain beats per minute will induce someone to be more tachycardic or bradycardic? Because obviously we give beta blockers to get someone to be more bradycardic, but I'm wondering, can you predictably give someone a slower song to calm them down? Maybe not in the setting of a, you know, a trauma victim coming in for ICU or whatever, but maybe in just ambient noise in there.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely not a, you know, one size fits all, you know, because everybody, music is such a personalized experience. And to your point, when your whole nervous system is activated, sometimes you just need medication. And that's just a reality of, you know, got to have some medication, you know, in partnership with some other supports. But I guess a great way to kind of illustrate how this works is I have some additional certifications for delivering music in the NICU with very, very fragile babies. And here at Hopkins, I've had the privilege of working in the cardiac ICU, just as an example, which is a lot of very young babies with very, very complex medical diagnoses, congenital heart diagnoses. Many are on ECMO. They can't take any more, you know, they've received the maximum amount of medication they can receive, and they're still fussy or still agitated, or they're on paralytics and there are concerns about their neurodevelopment. And so part of my role when I was working on that team was to really carefully and strategically introduce music. So I might be really looking at the monitor and really looking at that baby's face, looking for signs of overstimulation. Like very young babies, their face will get really red, or they'll have a grimace face, or they'll do something called a halt hand where they'll put their hand out in front of them, like, stop. And a lot of people think it's really cute, but it means they're probably really overstimulated and they're really trying to say, please stop. And so I might just hum, like just humming for 10, 15 or 20 minutes. And I might, you know, pick a really steady, like 60 or 65 beats a minute, something really slow. And I just hold that tempo and I'm humming about as quietly as I can hum. Maybe if I'm able to, I'm providing a little bit of touch or containment, like babies like to be squished. So a little love on their head and on their arms, whatever's accessible, if I'm able to do that. And oftentimes we will see pretty consistently, you'll start to see respiration rate dropping, heart rate dropping, sats coming up, 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 which is just our natural response to, you know, most young babies are, they're hearing all this noxious noise and, you know, they're hearing beeping on the split screen monitor. It's not even their monitor. It's the baby next door, but it's beeping and it's distressing and there's ECMO machines and it's a lot of sounds for a very small baby. And so it will take their brain some time to attenuate to the sound of my voice singing. But once they their brain starts to entrain, you'll often see their face relax a little bit. We'll see like really, really positive responses on the vitals, or sometimes just stable, which is a huge deal for someone who has very labile vitals. If all of a sudden they're able to hang out in kind of the same place, it's like, all right, something is happening. And so that might be something I would do multiple times a week, like essentially dosing exposure to music that's delivered really intentionally to support neurodevelopment, to expand their ability to tolerate different kinds of auditory stimuli, maybe adding in touch over time, maybe if and when they're able to be, you know, to sit up or to be picked up, to add a little vestibular, all of this kind of multimodal stimulation that's really, really important for very young babies who are in the hospital and they're not in a traditional environment where they're being picked up and rocked and held and all of those things. And so that's like, I feel like that's the best example of, you know, it's just pure, it's just singing, it's just humming, but it can have a pretty dramatic effect. And there's a pretty good body of literature and a lot of music therapists working in NICU contexts, in some states billing for it, but we haven't quite gotten there yet, but maybe one day.
I was actually going to ask about that. I was like, what's the ICD-10 code for love, right? Like for,
I think I'd have to look it up. I think there are some specific codes they'll use, because often I might help with, you know, accepting a pacifier. I might give a little bit of music just before a scheduled feeding time and be singing and also giving a little pacifier, because it's like a little reinforcement of, ooh, there's something in the environment. Ooh, I have this pacifier in my mouth. And now here's food. So, you know, I know music therapists will bill feeding related codes in hospitals where that's possible, and also like neurologic and multimodal stimulation. But I'd be interested to know specifically what the codes are.
I mean, especially one theme we've covered a lot on the Raise Line is the shift to value-based medicine. And like, how do we, you know, again, like I've talked about this forever, is how do we intervene earlier, be more proactive, be more preventative, and rather than waiting for someone to have tertiary quaternary care, get them earlier and also be more holistic. I mean, Osler, who started Hopkins, as we both know, the father of modern Western medicine, said one of the first jobs of a clinician is to inform the public not to take medicines, right? Like, right. Obviously, we all know there's a reason to take medicines and get the surgeries, but the more you can get people to be, you know, to be healthy and eat well and diet well, and also train parents how to do these, you know, evidence-based interventions that earlier on, I think the better the outcomes will be.
Absolutely.
So before I ask you final questions, I wanted to ask you about your passion for disability justice. Do you mind just telling us a bit more about that aspect of your
work? I always tell people that I'm, you know, a part-time doctoral student right now, a part-time clinician, and a full-time disabled person, because I don't know if there's any disabled or chronically ill folks listening, but it is truly a full-time job accessing healthcare, managing healthcare, dealing with, like, once a week I make medical phone calls, and it's just not it for me. And so coming into, you know, working in a medical setting, which is interesting for me because many of my own providers work in the same department that I do. I've seen my own doctors in the hallway. I've seen, you know, NPs and PAs, and it's been a really interesting thing for me to kind of meld my identity as a patient, which has been a very lifelong thing for me. And I have a very fluid disability. And so sometimes I don't visibly look disabled. I'm able to mask that. And sometimes I look super disabled and I'm using, you know, mobility aids and braces. I have hearing aids that I wear. And so it just depends on the context that I'm in. And so it's been really kind of cool for me, actually. I thought it was going to be super weird, like waving to my doctors in the hallway and now working on the same teams as them sometimes. But it's been kind of a really empowering experience. Something I knew I wanted to do when I came here was to get connected with folks who were engaged in disability advocacy work, folks like Bonnie Sweener at Hopkins, who is doing incredibly important disability advocacy work, both within Johns Hopkins as an institution, but like at a legislative and policymaking level in nationally. And so it's been really cool to start to get to know, you know, folks who are disabled and who are working as physicians or who are working in lots of different contexts. And so I'm on a cool committee that is sort of trying to improve experiences for disabled folks across the university by taking a really critical look at, you know, all of the services that are available and all of the, you know, things like facilities and the accommodations offices, and really trying to make some recommendations to improve experiences, because we know there's quite a body of literature that, you know, being disabled, that's a healthcare disparity that is well documented, that actually having a disability for many people is not the problem. It's the systems that they have to move through that actually make that experience so deeply disabling and frustrating and disempowering. And so I believe very strongly as a clinician, you know, that the fact that I am disabled and have lived experiences that often intersect with the folks I work with is kind of a special thing that, you know, I don't always disclose, but sometimes it's really relevant. I've had a whole session with a patient where we just talked trash about neurologists that we've seen. And it was a really awesome experience. You know, I love neurologists. I work in neurology, but sometimes, you know, you have a bad encounter and that bad encounter sticks with you way more than all of the good ones, and they accumulate over time. And so being able to, I think, normalize the experience of talking about bad encounters with other healthcare providers so that we can actually start to improve the way that people think about disabilities, because disability justice is like a framework that is really about recontextualizing the narrative of like that there are some bodies that are better than others. It's like all bodies are good, and disabled folks are really resilient and creative and move through the world in ways that really like impress me, and I find invigorating and playful and exciting. And I think I wish that more healthcare providers could see all of that joy and playfulness, and like disabled people will call it like crip magic, like the magic of being disabled. When you have to like fight your way through these systems, you find some really creative solutions. And I think that's a special thing. So it's great for me to be a part of that community and to try and grow that community here at Hopkins, while also trying to improve the experiences of, you know, disabled medical students who, you know, if you think about something like standing rounds, for me, I can't do it. I can't stand for that long. And so that would be, if I were a medical student, I'd be having to sit. But I know folks who've had difficulty even getting some basic accommodations, you know, because there's an expectation that medicine has to be done in a certain kind of way, when there's a lot of ways to do things, maybe even better, more sustainable ways to do things. And so that's like my side hustle at Hopkins, but it's something I really, really care about. And I hope to continue to get to engage in those conversations with folks across the institution, because I think it's really important.
Yeah, no, amazing. And thanks for sharing all that and being so open about it. Something that definitely at Elsevier, we care a lot about. So I just actually heard our CEO of Elsevier, she runs a 9,000 person organization. Her name's Kumsal Baizit. She just gave a talk to the entire company. And one of the key initiatives she mentioned is Project Sunflower, which is for people who have invisible disabilities. So people can wear.
Yeah. I have a lanyard that I wear at the airport, and people are nicer to you if you have it on. It indicates that you have an invisible disability and might need a little extra support. I think that's so dope.
Is it a sunflower or what is it?
It is. Oh, it's a sunflower.
Awesome. Yeah. So we have that at Elsevier, and I know we publish a disability and health journal here. Hopefully we publish the music therapy journals if we haven't, but I'll follow up and share that with you too, because maybe there's something more that Elsevier and Hopkins and, you know, one thing I love doing is connecting people can do together.
Yeah, heck yeah. And I think I've definitely read some stuff in that disability and health journal for sure.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's one of the Elsevier journals. That's awesome. Well, I've taken you over the time, so I just had two last questions for you. The first is, you know, obviously a lot of our audience are current or future healthcare professionals. What's your advice to them? Just general career advice and or advice about working with people like you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a physician, I'm a therapist, but, you know, I think if I could offer one piece of advice that comes from, you know, years of being a therapist and experiencing folks, experiencing healthcare, is just to be there, to pause and take a beat and to actually witness what the people that you're providing care to are going through. Sometimes I think, you know, and I'm guilty of this too, I'm moving through the day, I have a lot of referrals, I'm going from one thing to the next. And sometimes I don't even take a beat, even just 30 seconds to say, oh, that thing I just saw, or that session I just had, that was really big. Maybe I need to go walk outside for a minute, or I need to just take a drink of water. I need to do something to regulate myself, because I think a lot of healthcare professionals, me included, just get progressively more dysregulated as the day goes on. We witness a lot of tough stuff. We're not quite taught that it's okay to spiral and feel really overwhelmed when we're witnessing all of these tough things. That's something that was really hard for me when I came to working in a hospital, and it was like, wow, there's a lot of pain and there's a lot of suffering. And you can do a lot of good, but only if you're able to regulate and have an outlet for your own grief, that it's okay to feel grief and loss, that even if you've just met someone one time, like there's no requirement for feeling grief. You feel what you feel. And I think healthcare professionals, me included, experience a lot of disenfranchised grief. Like there's nowhere for it to go, so we'll just pack it down. But so I would encourage people to witness, to not look away, and to tune into what you're feeling in your own body and mind. And even if you can't just walk out of the hospital and leave, but maybe you can take a drink of water, you could take 3 deep breaths, or you could sit down for 5 minutes and just not speak and be silent, or listen to a song. Because I think when we keep pushing our grief and our dysregulation down and try to cover it up, it's impossible to move through. It has to go somewhere. And so to find little ways to release it, and then intentional big ways to release it when we can, I think is one way to have a much more sustainable practice that also normalizes all of the things that we feel and experience. I think that's so essential.
That's wonderful advice. And I'm glad you reiterated that and shared a couple of ways that you do it too. Because again, what you do, what we all do in the hospital is very, very heavy. It can be and often is, and you don't even notice it until, you know, you burn out and maybe don't want to practice anymore, which is obviously something that's happening a lot these days. My last question for you, anything else you want to share with our audience about music therapy, about disability justice, or anything else? Open mic.
Gosh. Well, if you're a healthcare professional, definitely you need to know your stuff about disability, and not like the gross stuff, like disabled people have worse quality of life. There's this really cool disabled doc, Lisa Iazzoni, and she has done a ton of research where she's surveyed doctors and has pretty much found a lot of physicians think disabled folks have a worse quality of life on the basis of disability alone. So unpacking some of the biases that, you know, we all hold about disability and finding ways to actually listen to patients and partner with them and like do the work, like read a book by a disabled author, get a little audiobook going or a podcast, or, you know, read. There are some amazing, amazing journal articles written by disabled doctors who have really put themselves out there to talk about some of the issues that they've encountered. So like, do the work and hire music therapists. When you are a physician, say, I want music therapy at my hospital. And music therapists love doing research and love building new programs. We're quite used to doing that. So like, find the music therapist working in your area and create jobs for them, because I think it's so important. I think I said this earlier, but to, you know, not just have music therapists there, but to be embedded as like part of the culture of the way that medicine is delivered, that it's not just about tending to the body, but it's also about tending to the mind and the spirit as well. And I think that makes for happier patients and patients who feel like their needs are being met in a more holistic way.
Yeah, those are wonderful take-home points to end on. And Carrie, thanks again for taking the time to be with us on the podcast, but more importantly, for the work that you do every day on both fronts, music therapy and disability justice. I really appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much. This was fun.
And with that, I'm Shibi Bani. Thank you to our audience for checking out today's show. And remember to do your part to raise the line and strengthen our healthcare system. We're all in this together. Take care.
If you like this podcast, please share it on your social channels. You can also subscribe to the series and check out all of our episodes at osmosis.org/raisethelinepodcast.